Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Thursday, November 12th, 2020. We have six cases on our calendar. This is our second of three oral arguments. I just want to make sure, Mr. Hajdukovic, could you please speak so we can make sure we can hear you clearly?
Yes. Good morning, Your Honor. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you very much. Mr. Russett.
Can you hear me, Your Honor?
Yes, I can. Thank you. Hopefully we won't run into any technological issues. If we do, we will certainly do what we can. If we need to adjust the time or stop it, we will do that. But with that, for this case, we have case number A20-0011. It is State of Minnesota versus Tao Feng Yang. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 5 minutes for rebuttal, if you so choose. And counsel for respondent state, you will have 15 minutes. With that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Stephen Russett. I represent the appellant in this case, Tao Yang. Mr. Yang is appealing his Washington County convictions for controlled substance offenses, including first degree sale of methamphetamine and fifth degree sale of marijuana. The sole issue before the court on appeal is whether or not the prosecutor committed prejudicial plain error. First, by eliciting testimony from five different police officers that based on their training and experience, the drugs Mr. Yang allegedly possessed were intended to be sold. And secondly, whether the prosecutors committed plain error in closing argument by arguing to the jury that Mr. Yang posed a threat to the residents of Washington County and that they should return guilty verdicts in part to show that they cared about the residents and families that resided in Washington County. I've addressed both of these sub-issues in my brief. It's my intent this morning, at least initially, to focus primarily on whether it was plain error to admit the testimony of the police officers. The resolution of that case, I would suggest, turns on whether or not that testimony was plainly and clearly inadmissible under controlling case law. That's the relevant inquiry because the Supreme Court has recognized that eliciting plainly inadmissible evidence is prosecutorial misconduct. And as the Supreme Court noted in Ramey, prosecutors are presumed to be familiar with the court's controlling case law. The testimony of the officers in this case was plainly and clearly inadmissible under controlling case law. The Supreme Court has held in a line of cases that witnesses may not express an opinion in a criminal case on issues that involve a mixed question of fact and law. And in the Chambers decision, the Supreme Court held that whether or not the defendant acts with the required intent that's under a statute is a mixed question of fact and law upon which an opinion may not be expressed by a state's witness. More to the point, this court's decision in Kohler addressed the specific issue before that is before the court now. That is the proper scope of a police officer's testimony in a drug sale case. Kohler makes clear, despite attempts by the state to muddy the issue, it clearly holds that officers are allowed to testify that a particular amount of drugs in the case are or are not consistent with personal use, and I don't dispute that. But Kohler goes on and says what is not allowed is an opinion as to whether or not an opinion in definitive terms and conclusion on the ultimate question of whether or not the drugs in this case were possessed with the intent to sell. In other words, the opinion holds that the officer cannot express an opinion in quote as a legal conclusion or quote in conclusive terms. So the distinction that Kohler draws is between an officer telling the jury that based on his experience, the amount of drugs that they discovered is consistent or inconsistent with personal use. That gives the jury information that the jury can then use to determine the ultimate question. Were the drugs in this specific case possessed by the defendant with the intent? What the officers cannot do under Kohler and the Supreme Court case law is tell the jury that the drugs in this case were for sale, in their opinion. That doesn't give the jury any information. It tells the jury how to decide the issue that is before them. It states the ultimate, it decides for the jury the ultimate question of whether the defendant acted with the requisite intent. Now, when that framework is applied to this case.
So Mr. Russert, you're saying then that Officer Sigtel's testimony, where he said, I believe he was involved in the sale of controlled substances, that crosses the line.
That clearly crosses the line, Your Honor. I don't think there's any question. I would suggest the testimony of the other officers to the effect that the drugs in this case absolutely were not for sale and absolutely were not consistent with personal use also clearly crosses the line because-
Torgerson says it doesn't appear to be for personal use, it's too much. Is that crosses the line too?
Yes, I think what is permitted under the case law is testimony that based on my experience, the amount of drugs is or is not consistent with personal use. And that's it. Anything beyond that, we're now over the line of what the case law permits. And again,
but the letter testimony that Judge Connolly quoted doesn't go to the issue of whether or not he was actually involved. He had the intent to sell controlled substances. The latter quote just goes to the amount and whether the amount was either for personal use or for sale.
You know, I think the specific quote that Judge Connolly quoted perhaps is close to the line. I do believe it's over. But let's remember the officers went much further, not just Sartell, but the other officers testified in absolute terms. The testimony went on to say that in their opinion, the amount absolutely was not consistent with personal use. That's a conclusion. That's conclusory. That's different than saying, in my opinion, this amount of drugs is consistent or not consistent. When you stated in absolute terms, you've stepped over that line clearly. And then to go further and say, in my opinion, the defendant had the intent and is a drug dealer, I don't think there's any question. We're way over the line, and that's clearly not admissible.
Mr. Russert, does your argument depend on the cumulative effect of witness after witness giving this type of testimony? For example, hypothetically speaking, if we had five officers who testified, but only one officer rendered this type of allegedly objectionable testimony, would your argument be as strong?
Well, it wouldn't be as strong, Your Honor, but I would still have an argument. I think the question would come down to really a question of whether or not the testimony of that single officer in your example would be prejudicial and is likely to have affected the jury's decision in the context of the other evidence. When you have five officers all saying the same thing, obviously that's going to carry more weight with the jury than a single officer. I also think in making that determination, we have to look at a couple of other factors. What is the issue in the case? Is the issue the defendant's intent as it was in this case? And if so, even the testimony of a single officer could have an impact on the jury's decision. We also have to look at how the prosecutor used that testimony that shouldn't have been there in closing argument. If we have a single officer's testimony and if the prosecutor in closing argument focuses the jury's attention on that testimony and tells them that in effect resolves the issue of intent for them, then I would say yes, a single officer's testimony itself could be reversible error. You don't need to worry about that. We have five officers all cooperating each other, and we have a prosecutor in closing argument telling the jury and reminding the jury that every officer in this case, all five officers, answered the question for them.
Russert, let's say for the sake of argument, we agree with you that there's an issue as to the opinion evidence. And I agree with Judge Gaitas. You know, I think it is different when one cop says it versus everybody. And, you know, at the end of the day, as I understand the theory of defense of your client, it was personal use, not drug dealing. Obviously, one of the issues on plain error is, you know, did it affect his substantial rights? And in looking at Judge Bjorkman's opinion in the unpublished case, Halland, which I know it's unpublished, but you know, I mean, I'm sure I speak for the panel. We all think Judge Bjorkman is, you know, pretty smart. she decided that, well, you know, no substantial rights are affected because there were 288 ecstasy pills and $800 in cash. She seemed to think that was enough for overwhelming evidence of guilt. I mean, I will just say, speaking for myself and not my cherished colleagues, there's a lot more evidence than that, than in here in this case, than Halland. I mean, the guns, the amount, the tissue paper on them, the phone, his DNA on the guns, cash plus counterfeit cash on both instances. I mean, how do you argue this is not overwhelming evidence of guilt, which does not prove his substantial rights were impacted? That's what I'm most interested in sure. Explaining to me.
I understand. And with all due respect to Judge Sparkman, I agree. Very intelligent and persuasive jurist. I think the court has to remember that the inquiry in determining whether substantial rights of a defendant were affected is whether or not there's a reasonable the state must prove there is no reasonable possibility that the erroneously admitted evidence likely had a substantial effect on the jury's decision. I agree that the quantity of evidence and the strength of the state's case on the issue is certainly a relevant consideration, but it is not the end all to the inquiry. Ultimately, the question is not how much evidence did the state have. The question is this testimony likely to have affected the jury's decision? Is it a reasonable possibility? And I would suggest that there's three reasons in this case, at least three reasons, why that standard was met. The state can't meet its burden of proving it didn't. First, let's go to what the critical issue in this case was. What was this trial about? With regard to the methamphetamine charge, the most serious charge, the first degree, the question was, did the defendant, not just whether he intended to sell, but whether he possessed those drugs. With regard to the marijuana charge, the question, it was a small amount of marijuana. The question for the jury was, even though it was a small amount, did he have the intent to sell? The officer's testimony in this case ultimately portrayed him as a drug dealer, which would go a long way in the jury's mind to showing not only did he possess the drugs because he's a drug dealer, but he also had the intent to sell. So it goes not just to the question of intent to sell, it also colors the jury's determination on the issue of possession, which was also in dispute in this case.
Mr. Russell, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Judge Ray.
Sorry, I was just going to say, but you know, we have a standard that we apply looking at the substantial effect, whether it has substantial effect, and that is, we look at three factors. We look at the strength of the evidence, and as Judge Connolly highlighted, there's a lot of evidence here. It's not just one or two things. It's a number of different things, and we have two incidents here. Two, we look at the pervasiveness of the allegedly improper testimony, and that goes to the issue of whether or not it's just zero, one, or five. And then three, we look at whether or not the defendant had the opportunity to rebut that testimony. And here we're actually looking at under the modified plain error standard because none of that testimony had been objected to. So when we look at those three factors, I'm trying to understand how, let's take Judge Gaitis's hypothetical. If let's assume Officer Sattell gave improper testimony. When we look at those three factors, how does that establish that error actually affected the jury's verdict? Looking at those three factors.
Well, Your Honor, let me disagree a little bit. I agree that those three factors are certainly relevant, but I don't think they're the end all. There are factors that inform this court's decision on the ultimate question of whether the state can prove that this did not influence the jury's decision. So again, the strength of the evidence is certainly a relevant factor, but you must view the strength of the evidence in the context of the issues that are before the jury, the pervasiveness of the misconduct, and the likelihood that it may have been used in a manner that would influence the jury's decision. So again, we have a lot of evidence that would suggest that perhaps the drugs were at least the methamphetamine. I disagree with regard to the marijuana. It's a small amount of marijuana. But the evidence might support a finding by the jury independently that the methamphetamine was for sale. But before the jury even gets there, they have to determine whether he was in possession. And that was a hotly contested issue in this case. He claimed that he did not, that the backpack in the back of the car did not belong to him and that he did not know that it contained drugs. The testimony in this case on that issue would also likely influence that issue, because calling the defendant a drug dealer, again, would likely lead to a layperson to believe, well, they must be his drugs. And then it's easy to go from there to, because he's a drug dealer, they're for sale.
Mr. Russell, following up on that point, I don't have as good a memory as I used to. He drove both cars, right?
Yes, he was driving both cars.
I don't remember what the evidence suggests. Did the state prove he was the registered owner of both cars, or I seem to recall he wasn't the owner of both cars.
My recollection is he was not the owner of the first car. He did own the second car, where the marijuana was found in during a subsequent search after he was arrested. The other reason I think there's a...
And in the second car... I'm sorry. Oh, no, I apologize. Second car, I can't remember, was that the Louis Vuitton bag or the Coach bag full of stuff?
Yes. I don't know which bag, but whatever bag it was, it was in a bag. There was a small amount of marijuana and I believe some other, the weapon and other evidence as well.
In the trunk of the car he owned?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the second one was the marijuana, but the first one was the meth?
The first was the large amount of meth in the backpack that was in the back seat of the car that he was driving. The second was the marijuana in the trunk of the car that he owned and was driving. I see my time is up, so I'll save the rest for a rebuttal.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent, you have 15 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning. May it please the court. My name is Nick Hajdukovic. I'm an assistant Washington County attorney, and I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota. This court should affirm appellant's convictions because the prosecutor did not commit plain and reversible error. And like Mr. Russett, I'd like to begin and regarding the alleged elicitation of plainly inadmissible evidence. And I think it's really important here for the court to properly articulate the test that is used in these cases. And I disagree with Mr. Russett's statement that it is misconduct for a prosecutor to elicit plainly inadmissible evidence. The implication of that would mean that there is no more regular plain error test for the admission of inadmissible evidence during the state's case in chief. That is, any elicitation of evidence that is plain error is misconduct and therefore is reviewed under the modified plain error standard in the Ramey case. And that just isn't the law, as far as I'm aware. And in fact, what I would submit is that the court needs to follow the Mosley decision from 2014 from the Minnesota Supreme Court that I cited in my brief. In Mosley, the Supreme Court stated that the test to be used in a situation like this is whether the prosecutor knowingly elicited evidence that was inadmissible for the purpose of bringing that inadmissible evidence before the jury.
Well, you know, counsel, I don't want to, I mean, I get it. And I think there is a difference between misconduct and error. So I'm not going to go there, but you're right. And it was explained to me by a prosecutor at the top of his voice that one is not the other. But here's my question. I think it's a fair point that the cases about what's opinion and the specific language, they are all over the place but let's, you know, once again, I'm going to rely on Judge Bjorkman's opinion, which I know is unpublished, but you know, there's a lot of stuff that's that of Judge Reyes and Judge Gaitis that's unpublished that, you know, I look at as Bible. In her opinion, she said, when the officers said, opined that the packages would not, that he would not believe that the 288 pills were a personal use amount, and likewise testified, I guess that's a different officer, that he believed the pills were packaged for resale, she said that's beyond the pale. and at least one officer here, oh my goodness, it's Officer Torgerson, maybe it's the same one. In this case, testified, it doesn't appear to be for personal use, it's too much. That seems like the exact language Judge Berkman had a problem with. Therefore, I'm simply going to tell you that's the exact language that I seem to have a problem with. So explain to me again, if you can't opine on intent or draw conclusions for the jury, how is that opining on intent and doing specifically what an officer is not supposed to do when he says it doesn't appear to be for personal use, it's too much? I mean, that sounds to me problematic, speaking for myself and not the panel.
Sure, and I certainly understand the concern. And my response would be, I guess, first of all, that an unpublished decision, I think unpublished decisions are maybe even more relevant than normal in the context of determining whether there's plain error. But I would also submit that unpublished cases by themselves probably cannot create plain error that would otherwise not exist, in the sense that my understanding of plain error is that it's error that violates essentially binding precedent, a rule, a statute, or essential precedent that a prosecutor or anyone is, oh, I'm sorry, Judge Connolly, I think you might be muted.
Judge Connolly, I think you're on mute.
Thank you, Judge Reyes. The binding precedent says an officer may not opine as to the defendant's intent or draw conclusions for the jury. Explain to me how it doesn't appear to be personal use isn't doing precisely that.
Well, what I would also point the court to is the decision in the Martin unpublished case that I cited in my brief.
I thought unpublished decisions don't matter. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, this is getting a little into the weeds on plain error, but I think that's why we're here, so that's okay. From my perspective, unpublished cases probably cannot create plain error, but they can help to demonstrate that any error is not plain. Because essentially my position would be if the unpublished cases are taking seemingly different approaches, it's hard to say that the law is clearly settled on an issue, which is a prerequisite for a finding of plain error.
Well, Mr. Hajdukovic, I would take issue with that because I think the first part is to determine whether or not there's error. Then the second is to determine whether or not that error is plain. And error is plain if it contradicts established case law. Established case law would be binding case law. So I don't think that unpublished cases can create binding case law. We have to look at the published cases to see whether it contradicts what is controlling case law. And so, I just want to make sure we're clear on that distinction there.
Right, and I think there's room for argument on exactly what the role of unpublished cases is in determining whether error is plain. And I agree that, you know, the first part is there error? And to push back again on and point out the test, I think the test for error in this particular context is whether the prosecutor knowingly elicited inadmissible evidence, and I'd submit there's no evidence in the record to support.
What if he accidentally admitted inadmissible evidence that affected the outcome of the case? Are you saying that the role of this court in that situation would to be to simply affirm?
No, absolutely not. What I'm saying is that it comes down to whether this is a question of prosecutorial misconduct or judicial error. In the sense that the judicial error comes in, and this is just a typical plain error analysis where the argument is the court should have stepped in and stopped this.
Okay, so are you acknowledging that this was judicial error then?
No, I'm not acknowledging that either under these facts. But what I'm saying is that the way the appellant in this case has chosen to frame the argument should make a difference in how this court analyzes it. The appellant here hasn't claimed judicial error. The appellant has claimed prosecutorial error, which requires under Mosley and other cases, knowing elicitation of inadmissible evidence. As Justice Hansen observed in his concurrence in the Jackson case from 2006 that I cited in my brief, choosing to frame the issue that way has a consequence of imposing that higher burden of showing a more knowing violation of the law. And the counterbalance to that is that if they do show that, they get the more favorable modified plain error standard of review from Ramey. So there's consequences to how the issue is framed. That's all I'm really getting at. There's certainly a role for the court, but it all depends on how the issue is framed in terms of what the test ought to be. And here again, I'd submit there's no evidence that the prosecutor knowingly did anything wrong. And for that reason, no basis to find actual error under the test for prosecutorial misconduct in the context of elicitation of allegedly.
Mr. Hajdukovich, I have Martin in front of me along with Halland, and I agree with you. It seems like the panel in Martin did not view this language as opining. You know, what's interesting is Judge Ross, who wrote that opinion in Martin, which is from 2009, was also on the panel with Judge Bjorkman in Halland in 2011, where the panel found the language was bad. So I don't know, maybe I'm speculating, but perhaps Judge Ross changed his mind. I don't know. But apart from that, I'm on this panel, and I think the language is problematic. So isn't your strongest argument that there was no, and again, I don't want to get into this debate about conduct, you know, prosecutor misconduct, prosecutorial error. Let's just say it was some plain error. Isn't your strongest argument that there was no substantial rights violated because, I mean, here I will say, speaking for myself only and not my colleagues, I've said evidence was overwhelming when it was a lot less overwhelming than this. And here, you know, it was actually two different occasions, which seemed to be pretty similar. So isn't your strongest argument that really that was what the jury was focused on as opposed to the language in terms of whether there was a reasonable possibility or probability that, you know, this made a difference? In case you're wondering, that's a softball.
Yeah, and I appreciate that, and I took it that way, and I will take that and run with it. I think it's absolutely a very strong argument, and though I'd like the court to resolve the question of what the test is in this context for prosecutorial misconduct versus judicial error, the evidence was frankly overwhelming. And what I'd also like to point out is that there's really two officers, I think, as you pointed out, Judge Connolly, during Mr. Russett's argument, that being Officer Satelli in one of his statements and Officer Torgerson, Detective Torgerson, in the other about that. The other three officers, though, as I read their testimony, basically said, this is not consistent with personal use, which I think is definitely not plain error. And so it's not just a statement of, the five officers all said this. I think that if there is error, it is limited to those two officers. And I don't think there's any authority making a plain error to say, even to say it's, I absolutely do not believe it's for personal use or words to that effect. I don't think that those adverbs change it from not plain error to plain error. So I'd submit that at most, there are two statements that are problematic. And the evidence, as you point out, is frankly overwhelming between these two incidents, between having guns both times, all the documents found in his name in the bag, with the large amount of methamphetamine, the DNA found on
the gun. What if the officer said, I think he's a drug dealer? No, excuse me. In my opinion, he's a drug dealer. Is, you know, good or bad?
I think that what I would say is this, there may be other reasons that that's inadmissible, like character evidence reasons potentially, but under the question of expert opinion, I don't think that that's plain error if we look at it purely in that context. Because in that particular context, what we have is, it's not a question of, we're not opining on his intent, which is really what the cases find to be problematic, is opinions on intent. Because I think it might be more problematic under a Rule 404 character analysis. But just looking at it from the question of expert testimony, it may very well be helpful to the jury, although perhaps problematic for other reasons. But so as I was indicating, I think the evidence, frankly, is overwhelming. The allegedly problematic evidence is fairly minimal. And the prosecutor, I think, in his closing argument to address that issue in terms of how he used that evidence, kind of lumped it all together, as I recall the closing argument. But, we have five officers all saying this. But when you look at what the actual evidence is, I think it's different from the different officers. And three of the five basically said it's consistent with personal use, or not consistent, I'm sorry, with personal use.
How do you respond to Mr. Russett's argument that as a threshold matter, this jury had to determine whether Mr. Yang possessed the methamphetamine, and the character of this testimony surely affected the jury's determination of that threshold issue?
Sure. I would push back against that and say that that is just, a small amount of the evidence in the case, and that the rest of the evidence of his possession is absolutely overwhelming, including the fact that with the large amount of methamphetamine, there's all these documents in his name in the same bag. We have some of the drugs found on his person. Another thing, maybe not most significantly, is the fact that he testified that, I don't know how my drugs got in this bag. He admitted the mail was his, the documents in his name. He admitted that, yeah, that's my stuff. But I have no idea how those drugs got in that bag with all my stuff. And the jury obviously rejected that testimony, which is additional evidence of consciousness of guilt in their rejection of his testimony, which they had to reject in order to convict him of possessing, much less possessing with intent to sell. So I think that the evidence of sale is probative on the question of possession, but the evidence of possession by itself is overwhelming.
Mr. Hajdukovic, the phone, was that in the first stop or the second one?
My recollection is that it was in the first stop when the phone was found.
And what did the phone say?
The phone had photos of drug dealing activity. The phone had text messages detailing drug dealing activity.
All relating to marijuana, though, right?
Yes, those text messages and sets and photos were related to marijuana. That is correct. I see my time has expired. Unless the court has any further questions, I would just ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for your rebuttal. And just hang on 1 minute while we get the clock set here. Thank you. You may begin.
The jury may have rejected Mr. Yang's testimony that he did not possess the methamphetamine because the officers testified that, in their opinion, he was a drug dealer. I don't think you can disconnect one from the other. That's what this trial was about, and that's why this testimony was so important to the state's case that they elicited it from five different officers. I can't emphasize enough that when determining whether or not this evidence may have influenced the jury's decision, that this court should not act as a 13th juror and decide whether you, had you been on this jury, would have convicted the defendant anyway. The ultimate question is not how you would have ruled based on the evidence that was presented. The question is there a reasonable possibility the wrongly admitted testimony had a significant effect on the jury's decision? And I would ask this court to take a look at State v. Litzau, which we cite in our brief, where the Supreme Court very bluntly stated, when evidence is intended by the prosecution to influence a jury's decision, we presume that it has such an effect. Let's look at the prosecutor's argument.
Ms. Russett, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, let's look at the prosecutor's closing argument in this case, which is a little bit different than what the state is arguing here this morning. In the closing argument, the prosecutor reminded the jury that that police officers with, quote, years and years of experience, unquote, all testified that, quote, oh no, and in, and quote, no way, were these drugs were these drugs for personal consumption. And one of them went so far as to testify that the defendant was a drug dealer. The prosecutor intended for this testimony to affect the jury's decision in this case.
Well, let me stop you there. I will stop you now, because it sounds like you're arguing prosecutorial misconduct versus prosecutorial error. And I believe in your brief, you're arguing prosecutorial error. In other words, it wasn't intentional. by the prosecutor?
The case law from the court does not, I mean, I understand that there are some cases that distinguish prosecutorial error from misconduct, but those cases also make clear the standard of review is exactly the same. Is there an error? Was it plain? Is it, and can the state show it did not affect substantial rights?
I just want to clarify that.
I will not quibble. Yeah, and I will not quibble with what you want to call this. I think the terms are interchangeable. If the case law says this evidence is not admissible, it is error and plain error for the prosecutor to introduce it.
Mr. Rusted, I want to turn to the second issue quickly because we actually haven't even talked about that. And I think it's important that we do because I think your main argument is that there's the cumulative effect of all this. The closing arguments, when I look at the closing arguments, it seems that your argument is taking some of the comments out of context in terms of holding defendant accountable. Now, granted, the prosecutor does use that word accountable, but the prosecutor also says in closing, in the rebuttal in particular, I'm now asking you to hold the defendant accountable for his actions because in this case, the evidence proves that he does whatever he wants, he needs to be held accountable. Why? Based on the overwhelming evidence of drug dealing, drug possession, it's all there. Hold him accountable, find him guilty of all five counts. Now, I understand that the concern about accountability language, but that language is tied to the overwhelming evidence. It's not a standalone, you need to hold him accountable because he's a bad person, we need to set a message. That seems to be a different argument.
I would agree, Your Honor, that under existing case law, if the prosecutor ties the accountability argument to proof beyond a reasonable doubt, there is no error, no misconduct. The gravamen of our complaint about the closing argument here is really focused on the other remarks about that portray Mr. Yang as a danger to the community. And the plea to the jury to show the community that they care about their community and to return a guilty verdict, not just because they proved Mr. Yang guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, but to send a message to the community that they, unlike Mr. Yang, care about the safety and welfare of the families that reside in Washington County. That is what changes and makes the argument improper in this case. It's the addition to the accountability argument, the argument that you need to do something to protect your community. This guy's a danger. He's running around the county with guns and drugs. Find him guilty. Show that you care. That's really the primary focus of my argument on the closing argument. And when you combine that with the improper testimony from the police officers, I think it makes a much stronger case for prejudice and reversal. Thank you.
Judge Reyes, I apologize once again. It must be my day to be chatty. I would like to ask two final questions of Mr. Russett.
Absolutely, yes.
Mr. Russett, the first question is, I did not see cumulative error mentioned anywhere in your brief. Is that a fair statement?
I would say it's not a fair statement. Our brief raised a single issue with two subparts and argued substantial rights combining the two issues together. Now, I honestly don't know that I cited the cases that talk about cumulative error, but I would be surprised if I didn't. But if I didn't, I think the way that we argued it was in fact cumulative.
Okay. My second question is, you know, I have to admit, I didn't really care for the whole public safety argument either in the closing, but I would interpret that as more going to the fact that, he kind of caught, this happened twice in, I don't know, 43 days. I thought it was more pushing that argument that, oh my God, you know, he keeps doing this over and over again. Would that be an unreasonable interpretation of the closing argument?
I interpret it differently. Let me say it that way.
Well, I would certainly hope so.
I think what's going on here is the question for the jury is, did he do it twice? Did the state prove that he did it twice? The argument that he's a threat to the community and you need to do something to protect your families is disconnected from that argument. It has nothing to do with it. It brings in a whole different question for the jury that they shouldn't be addressing.
Mr. Russett, I'm going to, because I'm presiding, I'm going to ask one last question. Isn't the closing argument, doesn't that contradict your statement? Because the prosecutor talks about overwhelming evidence of drug sales, drug possession, overwhelming evidence that proves the defendant has no regard. He doesn't care. He doesn't care for public safety, other people that are out there on the streets, other families in Washington County. And then the prosecutor comes back to that and says he was caught on August 26th. Then to Judge Connolly's point, it says 43 days later, he gets caught again. More drugs, more loaded firearms. So it's bookended, the statement about him being out there is bookended by the evidence and by the fact that he had got caught not once, but twice.
Prosecutor bookended an improper argument with a proper argument. Okay. And I don't think you should let them do that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you both for excellent oral arguments and excellent briefing as well. We appreciate that. We'll be issuing an order within the statutory timeframe. Have a good day. And